Why is Vanuatu's climate law proposal significant? And how many countries updated their climate goals ahead of COP27? Welcome to the Climate Recap for the Becosphere Climate Corner, your go-to place for international and U.S.-based climate news. I'm Becky Hoag, a climate communicator. Today is Tuesday, September 27th. Let's jump right into today's news. Before I start, I wanted to give you all a heads up that starting Monday, my climate recaps will be moved back to my main channel, the Becosphere Climate Corner. This means I will start providing a visual to these episodes to try to get this information out to more people. Thank you for supporting the growth of this second channel, and stay subscribed to it just in case I need to use it again. But I'm very excited about this change, and I hope you are too. If you are listening on Spotify, Google Podcasts, or Apple Podcasts, this won't change your listening experience. The Climate Recap Podcast will continue as is. Okay, let's start with some extreme weather events. President Marcos preemptively evacuated 8,400 people and closed all government businesses right before Typhoon Noru, a Category 3, made landfall on the Filipino island Luzon Sunday. Low-lying areas were flooded, and 180 miles per hour or 290 kilometer hour winds battered the area. It killed 8 people. Now Noru is headed straight for Da Nang, Vietnam, where over 800,000 people have already evacuated. It scored as a Category 4 storm today. Meanwhile, Tropical Storm Ian swiped Pinar del Rio, Cuba, with destructive winds, storm surges, and heavy rainfall that still continues today. It has now intensified to a Category 4 hurricane as it heads straight for Florida's west coast, particularly Tampa and St. Petersburg. Florida Governor DeSantis has called a pre-landfall state of emergency, and the National Guard is on standby to help with landfall efforts. Tens of thousands have been told to evacuate the area, as this might be the worst storm to hit Florida's west coast in a century. Time for some climate studies. It's no surprise to hear that the world is not on track to meet its decarbonization goals needed to keep warming well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. But how off we are is unfortunately still a gut punch. A new analysis by the International Energy Agency, or IEA, determined that we are behind in 53 out of 55 of the components needed to decarbonize on time to reduce the worst impacts of climate change, with the only two we're on track on being lighting and electric vehicles. The IEA puts the rest of the components into different tiers based on how badly we're doing. Mid-tier components are things that we are almost on track on but need to put more effort into, and low-tier components are things that we are totally off track on. Some items in mid-tier include renewable power, research and development finance, and direct air capture. In fact, most things in the electricity sector are mid-tier, which makes sense because we have prioritized this sector. Some exceptions to this, though, are how slowly we're dropping coal, carbon capture and storage technological development, and energy efficiency retrofits. Energy efficiency being on the lowest tier annoys me the most because it would reduce how much energy we would need to add to the grid, and it would greatly help in cases like the energy crisis Europe will experience this winter. It's such a comparatively inexpensive fix compared to adding more energy generation to the grid, updating the grid's infrastructure to take more, and adding battery storage to keep the clean energy consistent. Very disappointing. Some other component ratings put hydrogen technology in mid-tier, while biofuels remain in low-tier. Most heavy industry targets like steel, chemicals, cement, aluminum, and pulp and paper are in the low-tier. And reducing methane emissions is probably one of the most off-track components there is. We are going to need a rapid reduction in methane emissions over the next 8 years if we want to meet our decarbonization goals. Methane is 84 times a more potent greenhouse gas than CO2 for the first 20 years they're in the atmosphere, and it is mainly emitted through leaky infrastructure and flaring when we're not talking about the agriculture sector. It's a low-hanging fruit to reduce greenhouse gas emissions effectively. As a reminder, the closer we get to 2 degrees Celsius of warming, and we're currently at 1.1 degrees Celsius, the more likely we will tip global ecosystems to an irreversible state, including a mass die-off of tropical coral reefs. Switching gears, flood gardens could provide a beautiful solution to urban flooding, according to Natural England. Flood gardens are essentially mini wetlands that give the water somewhere to go besides hanging out on the concrete. Reducing concrete and increasing flood gardens, also known as bug gardens, in people's backyards might help increase biodiversity while making a community more resilient to flooding and even droughts because it captures the water that would otherwise flow into storm drains. If you live in a flood and drought-prone zone, as more and more of us seem to be, and this sounds interesting to you, I will leave a link to the article in the source list. Everything I say will be in the source list. And that brings us into the climate victories. Climate protests broke out in 450 locations around the world last Friday as young people from New Zealand to Germany to the Democratic Republic of Congo demanded wealthy countries fairly compensate poorer nations for disproportionate harm climate change has already done to them. We are less than 2 months away from COP27, the next UN climate conference, which will take place in Egypt. These protests were organized by Fridays for Future, and they coincided with the UN General Assembly meeting that took place in New York last week, as well as Climate Week in New York City. At least 2,000 people marched down Lower Manhattan. Kids left school for these events, saying, "What's the point of learning in school if they have no future?" Meanwhile, the small island nation Vanuatu has called for a global treaty to phase out fossil fuels, becoming the first country to do so. They call it a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty, bringing up imagery of nuclear non-proliferation. The treaty also calls on the International Crime Court to add ecocide to the list of internationally punishable crimes. No environmentally based Rome Statute currently exists, making it challenging to punish companies and countries that destroy other countries' environments. This world treaty is supported by the Vatican and the World Health Organization, in addition to 65 cities and governments internationally. In Australia, Queensland announced a plan to build the country's largest publicly owned wind farm in an effort for the state to become a, quote, global renewable energy superpower. This could be a big shift for Queensland, which is Australia's most emissions-heavy state for its coal use. It also has the weakest 2030 clean energy goal at just 30% by then. But the $776 million Tarong West project would build 150 wind turbines by 2024, which will be enough to generate 500 megawatts of energy. That's enough to power 230,000 homes. Queensland is also expected to present a 10-year energy plan soon. And in Europe, the UK is set for an onshore wind boom after the government announced it would relax planning restrictions for this form of clean energy. This is an interesting change, as we've mostly been talking about Prime Minister Truss's moves that have pushed back climate action, like restarting fracking or promising more oil and gas exploration lease sales in the North Sea. But the growth plan unveiled recently shows an interest in increasing clean energy production in the country as well. Now, this mostly will change the trajectory of England, as Scotland and Wales have remained supportive of onshore wind development and will continue to reject fracking development. Onshore wind developers like Octopus Energy said the industry is excited to ramp up in England as soon as possible. A caveat is that wind farms can only be built in areas defined by local authorities as suitable, and only 12% of English councils drew up a development plan. So that's the next hurdle wind companies will need to jump. Time for the climate fails. This first one is a doozy. All 193 countries were required to update their National Determined Contributions, or NDCs, by last Friday, preferably to more ambitious goals. NDCs are basically decarbonization pledges. Well, the deadline has passed and only 19 countries actually follow through. This doesn't bode well for COP27. The only country that really had an impact from its NDC update is Australia, which reflects its recent change in leadership. The country has pledged to reduce emissions by 43% by 2030. This target still lags behind its peers in North America and Europe, but it's a positive change for the 15th historically largest emitter. Meanwhile, Brazil is the biggest example of a country decreasing its NDC ambition. South America's largest country is now shooting for a 50% reduction in emissions compared to 2005 levels by 2030, which is lower than its ambition set in 2016. This also reflects the country's leadership. Most of Brazil's emissions come from agriculture destroying the Amazon. Experts say most of Brazil's NDC is greenwashed, too. In the world of finance, the UN-backed Net Zero Asset Owner Alliance, or GFAS, which we talked about on Friday, is beginning to leak members. As a reminder, GFAS is made up of about 500 financial institutions that manage $135 trillion, or 126 trillion pounds. When done right, alliances like GFAS are valuable ways to hold institutions accountable for reducing their own and their portfolio's emissions. Otherwise, they might not have someone to check them. But with growing interest in catching greenwashing, which is when a company advertises their environmental efforts to seem better than they actually are, some GFAS members are finding themselves without a proper plan to follow their ambitious pledge. On Friday, we talked about how Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan Chase, and Bank of America, three of the largest and most polluting banks in the world, were threatening to leave GFAS last week for fear of being sued for not following through with the alliance's ambitious goals. But actually, the first to leave the alliance is the London-based pension fund CBUS and the Austrian pension fund Bundespensionskasse. The Austrian pension fund didn't respond to questions on why it left, but CBUS said it was to focus on internal climate efforts instead. It listed the administrative burden in decarbonizing its portfolio in a timely manner, which was the same reason the three U.S. banks cited. Hopefully, the coming wave of regulations and standards will help financial institutions prioritize decarbonizing their portfolios regardless of their membership with the alliance. And for the last climate fail, we go to ExxonMobil. We've known for a long time that fossil fuel companies have lied to the general public about the impacts of their product, hence why there's currently a U.S. House investigation looking into that matter. The most recent evidence of this poor behavior came in the form of 1993 proprietary documents collected from Exxon's Canadian subsidiary, Imperial Oil. Imperial Oil is one of the main oil companies behind the infamous polluting Alberta tar sands. The documents direct company leaders to stress the main uncertainties of implementing a national tax on greenhouse gas emissions when talking to journalists and politicians. This is despite the company's internal paperwork showing they studied the policy and found that it could cause national emissions to plateau and shrink without doing much damage to the economy. If Exxon had supported these policies in the 1990s, we could have already seen carbon emissions peak by now. All of this information and more can be found in 350.org founder Bill McKibben's new book, The Petroleum Papers, Inside the Far-Right Conspiracy to Cover Up Climate Change. Finally, I want to finish today's episode with an update on West Virginia Senator Manchin's attempt to add an energy permitting bill to the government's spending bill. Speeding up the energy permitting process is very important because it has made it difficult for clean energy projects to enter the grid once built. It was the main missing link in the Inflation Reduction Act to mobilize the clean energy transition. Manchin's bill has gained the support from the White House and Senate Majority Leader Schumer to attach his bill to the spending bill, but he still lacks support from most Republicans and progressive Democrats. On the Democrat side, the main concern is that this bill wants to streamline the permitting process by potentially weakening environmental protections. To try to quell this concern, Manchin has recently toned down the bill by removing the part that would change the Clean Water Act to make it harder for states to block pipeline projects. I'm not sure that this was the only environmental protection issue, though, as I saw other articles saying the bill could go against the National Environmental Policy Act, which requires environmental assessments before projects can be approved. Meanwhile, Republicans are against anything that has to do with the Inflation Reduction Act. To try to change their views, Manchin recently highlighted all the great things the bill could do for the fossil fuel industry on Fox News to spur Republican support. He claims that it will boost domestic gas production, which will help bring down inflation, despite gas companies already sitting on land permits that they could use to increase supply if they wanted to. The Senate will vote on this bill today. I will keep you posted as I learn more. And that was your climate recap for Tuesday, September 27th. If you like the work I do, please follow this podcast, give it a 5-star rating, leave a review, and consider checking out the Becosphere Climate Corner YouTube channel. Remember to talk about the climate crisis every single day and to support your local news organizations. Bye for now.